Come on! Come on, just a little reception. Oh, good. A signal.
Fascinating. You must kill other people.
Kill other people? But what have they done to me? I don't need to kill them. I can drink them under the table.
Yes, Bat. But they have tequila. Tequila that you deserve. Tequila that they're healing from you.
But how would I go about killing them? I don't even own a set of shears.
All you need to do is kill.
Kill? I don't subscribe to the Fox Network.
If you go kill them, Doris will ask for more alimony.
She'll do that anyway.
Then kill all the lawyers.
They'll ask me to pay more.
Then kill yourself.
Why do you think I'm drinking?
Okay, so I am here with a number of gentlemen who are behind the horror film The Signal. Perhaps we can go around the table and you might want to introduce yourself, and then I guess we can go ahead and start with questions based off of that.
My name is Jacob Gentry, and I directed number two.
As he likes to say.
Yeah. I did number two.
Oh, man. My name is Dan Bush. I am the writer and director of Transmission Number 3.
Okay.
My name is A.J. Bowen, and I played Lewis Denton in the film.
My name is Scott Poitras, and I played Clark.
And my name is David Bruckner, and I directed the first Transmission.
Okay, well, first off, I think we should probably talk about the rules of this particular dystopia. I mean, what did you do to settle upon these rules? I mean, it seemed to me rather interesting that if you do listen to a mix CD, you don't actually become a homicidal maniac. That's something of a sense of comfort to me. But what rules did you sort of lay down for this particular film in terms of the signal that plagues these various people and turns them into lovely homicidal maniacs?
Anything that's transmitted or received over the airwaves is what is a conduit for the signal, but the CD player is a closed circuit, so it functions in its own mechanics. But anything that receives signals from
mechanically, the signal hits everywhere, fast and hard. All TVs, all cell phones, all radios, anything that can receive the signal. It hits hard, and people have different relationships with the signal and different degrees of it drives them to madness, or it exploits their fears and desires in such a way that some people snap pretty quick, other people don't snap for a while, and other people don't snap at all.
I'm curious in terms of the consistency of this film, which has been remarked upon by many, since we actually have two actors here who had to maintain a certain level of consistency of performance across three different transmissions or three different segments. What steps did you do to ensure that all of the actors, that you were able to offer your own personal touches as directors while simultaneously allowing these actors to flesh out their respective characters? Maybe you can all sort of talk about this.
We were totally dependent on these guys to help us with, you know, if there's any sort of continuity throughout the movie as far as the tone and the feel and the character arcs, it's because of these guys.
That's Dan, a director, saying he was dependent on the actors.
That's right.
just making clear, that's what's being said.
But these guys, absolutely.
This is Scott. Speaking for probably both of us, I would think. No, I'm going to answer for both of us. You don't get to talk. It was really easy with all three directors on set every day because... speaking of continuity in your character, of course we were, responsible for what we did with our characters, but it was really easy to be held accountable with all three directors there every day. One behind the camera, one either setting up the next shot or working with us in a scene, and the other, I don't even know what the other one did. Probably nothing.
Well, maybe the three directors could talk about that.
Yeah.
So each one of you helmed a particular transmission. So what did the other two of you do on the course of that transmission? Did you switch it off on cinematography or?
Yeah.
What?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like we tag team directing. So mm-hmm. It's like we'd be shooting out a location, and we'd be one of us would be directing, one of us would be shooting for the other, and then one would be in the other room like prepping a scene, drawing out some storyboards or hiding. Mm-hmm. One or the other.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, now, in terms of having Lewis and Clark, did you essentially have characters named Lewis and Clark so you can just have that gag about them being Lewis and Clark? Or what was the deal with that? And Lewis and Clark happened to be here, so...
It's just one of those writing things where you get to that part of the... You have these characters you've created, and they're very thorough in your head, and then you get to that part, and you go, wait a minute. And you go, should I write this or not? And then you're like, yeah, well, why not?
Well, in naming Terminus, was this named after the Roman god in the sense of...
No, it's actually the original, basically our fictional city, which we've sort of created an entire, like, sort of Middle Earth, you know, for ourselves, like a Tolkien universe that is Terminus. But Terminus is sort of to Atlanta, Georgia, where we shot the film,
yeah,
as what Gotham City is to New York, or okay, Metropolis is to New York.
I was thinking you guys were Asimov fans or something.
Yeah. No, it's actually an alternate universe. Yeah. It was actually the original name for Atlanta because in the 1800s, because it was a terminus for all the railways. Huh. But then right immediately after that, they changed it to Marthasville, and then it became Atlanta. We questioned whether or not we should call the city Marthasville, but, you know, we thought that was kind of...
No one leaves Marthasville.
No one leaves Marthasville. Can you escape Marthasville?
Probably.
New Year's Eve in the city of Marthasville.
All of Marthasville. People are crazy.
That would be like more of a... It'd be more of a...
Toilet.
It'd be more of a... Maya Denton's having a bad day. Yeah. It only takes one little signal to turn it all around.
Well, Maya, of course, is Sanskrit for illusion as well. I'm curious. I mean, it seems I was seeing a lot of mythological terms in this as well. I mean, then I guess I suspect, was Maya named after Sanskrit, or was Maya something total altogether different?
I can't. We were talking about this the other day. This is Dan speaking. I think Dave came up with a name, but I immediately caught on in my mind that it was the Hindu idea of illusion.
Yeah.
So I was like, that's perfect. You know,
I had a huge crush on this girl named Maya many, many years ago, and then Dan was like, you know, it's got all kinds of other meanings. I'm like, cool, that's a decision.
That's why it works to have three directors. You get these three perspectives on the name. You know, I actually spelled it wrong completely differently than these guys did for a month, and then I lost that battle. Because Maya can be spelled multiple ways, and so can Louis. But I've always felt that L-O-U-I-S is Louis.
Yeah,
Louis.
So
he's definitely writing.
L-O-U-I-S.
Definitely writing. He should have been a French exterminator. Louis.
I suppose I'm hung up on the illusion thing largely because there's that profile shot of Maya driving, where you have essentially the longest takes in the film are of her on the side in the driver's seat as she's driving, and you see this sort of window passing by. So I'm wondering about the sense of illusion versus reality that kind of goes throughout this film, whether the name kind of enhance this, or how did this profile shot come about?
Yes.
No, I mean, it's something that...
You're onto something there.
Yeah, I mean, actually, perspective was something that we talked about a lot making the film. In fact, it was the justification to do three different storylines in this world, was that if we were going to release this signal on the population, it was going to get inside people's minds, and they're, you know, they were going to rationalize their way to violence. Some people would. Some people would rationalize their way to freedom, you know, maybe make different choices for their life. It would affect everybody in different ways, that we needed to get inside their perspectives to kind of understand how the signal is affecting them. And so that was the justification for the structure of the whole movie. There's this love triangle, and you're going to see it from each of their point of view, and they're all nuts in their own special way. So when we get inside their head, the world's going to look a little bit different. And that's why you get this kind of tonal, channel-changing, you know, over-mediated vibe from the entire film. So yeah, illusion and reality, what's real and what's not, was definitely something we're always playing with.
In terms of the humanist angle of the Maya Ben love story, was this a response to a kind of a climate of horror films in which there's a lot of, I guess, winking at the audience? I mean, there's certainly winking at the audience in this particular film as well, but I'm wondering if you feel that some horror films or contemporary horror films are not so humanistic in scope in terms of wanting to explore human stories.
I think any movie, no matter what the genre is made better by having a human story at the core of it. You know, I think that especially with narrative film, I mean, any kind of genre if you have a love story at the root of it, you know, I mean, that's all the great stories, no matter what the genre. And I think that if you let the tail wag the dog in terms of the genre, then it's just going to be sort of empty, aesthetics. But then if you, you know, sort of have that character base for everything, I think it's just a much more exciting and compelling story.
Yeah. Were there varying levels of psychosis that were encouraged in the actors here? Or maybe they can respond. were you encouraged to get in touch with your inner id in any particularly innovative or sort of intuitive way? Or did this just kind of come natural? These, you know, the murder and the strange, also the decorum of sort of still eating a pretzel at a party. Well, simultaneously, the whole atmosphere is blood-soaked. And now you're eating almost a pretzel, not a bagel.
There was some slight nodding and prodding, but the most part it was, you know, It was such a hands-on experience that it wasn't very difficult for me to get angry at Justin Welborn because of how many times he hit me by accident. But there were moments where I remember specifically, this is AJ, by the way.
So soft-spoken, I'm shocked.
I'm very mellow.
Yeah.
Wait till this cup of coffee's gone. Dan pulled me off to the side in the middle of us shooting a very important moment and said, "Hey, that guy's fucking your wife." And I was like, "What?" And I guess he was trying to motivate me to get me really excited. And I was like, "Oh, you just want me to do more acting. I'll act more, Dan. You don't have to go tell me that my wife's having an affair." I don't think that answers your question.
It gets there, though. I mean, the line also when you say, when you scream before the signal, "I'm having a moment with my wife." How did this kind of come about, this sort of implication of pre-existing conditions that were kind of encouraged or furthered or sort of brought out by the signal?
Well, we just wanted to set some stuff up that, you know, the signal is kind of like, it just pushes the first domino piece, you know, and then the rest of it kind of falls on its own. So it's like, you know, part of the film is that these people that are freaking out, you know, Lewis's character is kind of already on edge. I mean, he knows his wife's cheating on him, but he doesn't have the guts to bring it up in the room, and neither does she. So they're both kind of living in this lie. So when, you know, when he looks into the signal, he's going to freak out and start blaming everybody around him. So there was just this kind of tension that we wanted to start with, and, you know, maybe something everybody has kind of felt at one point or another, not being able to call the painful elephant in the room out.
Yeah. Everybody's flawed in the movie anyway. I mean, all the characters have deep flaws. And I mean, and you were talking about Maya and the illusion. I mean, with Ben, here he is living this sort of artificial life, and he won't actually ever make the move he wants to make to freedom, or and Maya won't do it. And so, you know, in the end, when the apocalypse hits, then that becomes the thing you fight for, whether it's real or not, because it's all you've got, you know. But is it too late at that point or not is the question, I guess. So, you know.
I also wanted to ask you about the Jim Parsons character in light of what you mentioned about Terminus in Atlanta. He says, "Oh, well, hey, I would fuck an Indian girl at one point." And this was interesting to me because I was wondering if you represented some sort of nascent colonialism or something like that. What happened with that? Yeah, you're cheering now.
No, that's exactly the conversation we had, right?
Nascent colonialism was definitely at the forefront of our mind. We were deciding whether or not he should say pee in her butt or...
I gotta tell you, these guys are the most vapid human beings I've ever met.
I don't even know what nascent colonialism means.
We've only watched the movies. We've never actually read Lord of the Rings.
There's a freedom and slavery motif going on, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I've read Everybody Poops.
The Popeye motif, too.
How much should one read into this movie? I mean, there's
as much or as little as you want to, because, I mean, that's sort of the great thing about movies is the subtext. And the subtext is something that you, even as a filmmaker, you know, you can have in your mind what you want to do with it. But ultimately, you know, it's a conversation you're having with cinema to the audience, and that conversation doesn't always exist in the intellectual, you know. It's more of it's an emotional art form in a lot of ways too. Yeah. So the intellectual, like, discoveries that you make sort of happen afterwards, you know, and it's a fun, you can have the fun thrill ride of the movie, which is just, I mean, it's a roller coaster of, you know, screaming and laughing and being scared, and then, you know, and, you know, having the love story, and there's absurdism and all these kind of things and action. And then at the end of it, you can kind of go to the coffee shop or the bar with your friends and, you know, fight it out. What do you think, you know, the ambiguity, or what do you think it all means, you know? And that's kind of the fun part about, you know.
But if this is it essentially entertainment first and any sort of social allegory that you
absolutely
put in the signal
absolutely
second? Or?
Absolutely. And entertainment is not the same thing as distraction, you know, as Mamet says. And if entertainment is meant to be an engaging and compelling, you know, story, you know, ultimately, that... you know, convinces the audience that this is, you know, to believe in the story of these characters, as opposed to just sort of mindlessly, you know, distracting them away from their normal lives.
There's similarities between the storyline of this and Stephen King's novel Cell, which
what?
Have alluded to. but actually, I'm going to sort of ask you about this, if there are, in fact, any particular books or storylines you may have based this on. Because George Romero has constantly said in all his interviews that essentially the Night of the Living Dead, he ripped off Richard Matheson's I Am Legend. So if you're kind of framing an allegorical entertainment along these lines, do you need some sort of pre-existing storyline with which to kind of kickstart this or galvanize this? Or?
There was a experimental film project we did called The Exquisite Corpse, it's a surrealist experiment where a filmmaker makes, or where they have start a drawing and then hand it off to the next filmmaker. And we had sort of gone through the process of doing that with a short film, and a lot of the root core like nuggets of some of the ideas that ended up being The Signal were in that, you know, and we sort of streamlined it and made it more.
That was like 2003. So we've been working on a lot of different film projects, and this was just one sort of thread that had been kind of dancing around in everybody's imagination. But as far as what you pull from, I mean, all of the movies are bouncing around in your head. I don't know that we specifically modeled anything after anything else specifically, but a lot of it too, I mean, you wonder what you pull from. A lot of it too is just feeling, and not in an intellectual way, but feeling over inundated with media, you know? If you're listening to talk radio, if you're watching a lot of cable news, you know, C-SPAN, TV, TV commercials, all of these things, and the general noise of that can kind of create an agitated sort of feeling, you know, and you can get the sense that you're losing your own voice amidst all of this noise. And that's kind of the sensation that I think that's what we pulled from a lot. That was a lot of the impulse to do this thing, is going, all right, well, what would happen if you concentrated all this into one signal and spat it out? Would you freak out? Would you go crazy?
And there's that point, too, and, you know, like even Ben Capstone character later in the movie says, it's replacing my thoughts. You know, and that's a real key to, I mean, whether or not, you know, if this is just an exaggeration of something that's already happening, that's, you know, that's kind of an interesting thought.
That's just how you feel, you know? I mean, and that's something that you think other people probably feel the same way, and so that's the impetus to kind of make it. But as far as, like, what you're pulling from...
It also makes the setup a little scarier. Because if it's something that could happen and people believe it could happen, I mean, in the same way that people... I mean, one of the reasons The Exorcist is one of the most horrifying movies of all time is because when that movie touched on the cultural zeitgeist, because... At the time that The Exorcist came out, I mean, I think 70% of Americans believed that, you know, demon, devil possession was actually possible and happens. So it was something that if you believe it and it's a conceit that you can buy into, then it is more related to your own life and actually can make it more scary.
My mom was pregnant with me in Georgetown when that movie came out.
In Georgetown?
I was born in Fairfax. They lived in D.C. area. My dad was working for the government at the time.
Unbelievable.
So they lived down the street from actually those stairs. So my mom was pretty freaked out.
Yeah, I mean, just think about how many people actually take showers. And, you know, Hitchcock just, you know, knew that showering was something that was sort of on the rise in Americans when he made Psycho, and was like, man, we got to really do something about the showering thing. People, I think 70% of Americans were taking showers at that point.
But you know, if there are other similarities to stuff that's coming out, I mean, we like to think that, like you're saying, in the zeitgeist, it's just ideas that are kind of out there in the swarm that people are picking up, you know. I mean, Cell came out when we were in post-production or production. The book came out, and I think they Entertainment Weekly published like the first chapter, and somebody threw it down and we read it and we're like, whoa, you know, that's definitely got some similarities, but it seems very, very different. And you know, and then there's a lot of ideas people have tossed around that are similar. But if, you know, being over inundated by your media or all the technology around us that's kind of outrun our culture being something that sort of scares you a little bit, that's going to be something that authors and storytellers are going to play on across the board and have for quite some time, you know.
And dependent on your media for some sense of perspective about the world and sense of yourself in the world. I mean, that's what's kind of happening, is the corrosion of you know, the identity in some weird way. And to what, you know, I don't think we were trying to get on a soapbox about that with this at all. But, you know, how can you avoid it?
And yet, also, this film comes out a few weeks after Diary of the Dead, which also deals with media. Is that, do you think that horror now is really the only realm where one can, I guess, analyze these issues? That essentially any kind of commentary on some disease-like form of media has now been pushed to the limits of something like the horror genre? Or?
I don't think of it so much as horror analyzing these issues as these issues being shit we're scared of, you know? So horror tends to like pick up the thread there and find its own way.
Okay. I mean, this brings to mind, is something like The Signal a more kind of intuitive approach to filmmaking, or is how does your planning of such a film relate to the kind of intuitive nature of a particular choice? Like, to look at also, you know, AJ, he actually has work boots at one point that resemble ashes from the first Evil Dead movie. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to ask you about that. Is something like that more of an instinctive choice or more of a kind of playful homage or what?
I think if we stumble upon that stuff, you know, then, I mean, this, all of that stuff, all the movies that we've ever seen are part of our psychopia. They're all part of our, you know, the language that we have in our head, the stockpile of images that make up our experience, whether they're from stuff we've actually seen or the media that we've, you know, been fed throughout our lives. And I don't think, personally, when I was starting to write this, I think the best thing that I could do is put out those images, like close my mind and go, you know, if I think about what Kubrick was doing or John Carpenter, it's really intimidating. These are my heroes. So, the best thing I can do is start fresh and go, okay, what is this character seeing right now, and how is he going to get from this point to this point, and what's at stake for him, and then, you know, the language of how you tell that story, I think, comes after that, and hopefully is more instinctual. You know,
I think that's certainly a post, more of a postscript effect, and that's a nice thing about if you get the opportunity to like view your own work, is you can see those references beforehand. But I don't think that anybody goes out and tells. I'm sure maybe some do, but
I personally have no ideas of my own, and the entire transmission was a mixtape of other horror movies. Yeah,
into one movie,
exactly.
All are represented.
Should we introduce Jim Parsons?
There
sure.
He is.
Yeah. Sure. You want to have him come on?
Yeah, absolutely.
You were just asking about him a second ago.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's Jim Parsons.
He asked about our. We were discussing the nascent colonialism.
to fuck an Indian girl. So you know, yeah. Is this? Maybe you can bring some thoughts as to whether this is a question of American imperialism or just a sort of funny lie.
I was a big Tecumseh fan growing up, actually, in Ohio, and I was an Indian guide because of that, and I've had fantasies of Indian girl squaws of that sort probably since I was 10, just blazing the Blue Ridge Trails of Ohio.
Okay.
Yeah. So it just
brought a lot of personal experience to this all then. Yeah. Okay.
Well, the explorer part, and then you know that their names are Lewis and Clark.
Of course.
It just sort of made sense.
The Signal is essentially an allegory of Western conquest.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Horace Greeley was speaking to me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, I wanted to ask you guys about the use of everyday common household goods, like duct tape and knives and things along those lines. I mean, there's a very kitchen sink. In fact, duct tape seems to be, you know, I'm wondering if you guys were like using the sort of notion of gaffer tape being the solution to everything that naturally led to duct tape being the solution for everything in this particular film.
How many times have you thought, if the shit went down, what would I grab in my house, you know, or in the middle of the night, if you know somebody's banging on your door, or you've ever had a fantasy of what if I had an intruder, I'd want to get to the utility closet, because there I've got hedge clippers, I've got that metal bucket, and I've got, you know, a screwdriver or something like that. So I think it just came out of sort of running from that, and or running for those kinds of ideas, and then also having to kind of one-up each other between the directors and thinking creative ways to defend yourself. So,
In terms of the look of the characters, maybe how much did the actors bring to the part? You were sort of suggesting earlier that essentially you were reliant upon these guys, and so I'm wondering, were you reliant upon? What did you do in terms of like costuming and Lewis's exterminator outfit and things like that? The work boots I had alluded to earlier.
My wife actually was the wardrobe. She did the wardrobe design on this thing. I think Jacob was really adamant about trying to identify these characters and give them their own. I mean, ideally, you know, we'd go into Forbidden Planet sometime and see Lewis and Clark and, you know, Ben Capstone up on their, you know.
It's really a question of what would look good as an action figure, you know, if it ever got to that point. So it's like, how do you identify them as action heroes?
Right. Yeah. So we were looking for things like the tinfoil hat, as you know, an
awesome iconography. Thing
that comes out. Iconography.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is that like you in the best opportunity possible when you're crafting character or story, you're wanting to look for something that is as iconic as possible and less homogenized. And so, you know, like specifically in the case of Lewis, the uniform. Jacob and I, we literally had at least a 45-minute conversation about shirt tucked in or untucked.
Yeah.
Really.
Well, I mean, it matters. It matters. Yeah, I mean, all that stuff matters to, I mean, it's just those little bits that add up to the whole, you know what I mean? And, you know, one of my favorite sort of costume things is Scott's character Clark wears a shirt that says Southern Gothic, which is actually the show within the movie of our first movie, Last Goodbye, that we did, and it was a TV show inside of that, and we made a shirt for that. And
didn't you want him to wear a rat tail originally?
I really wanted a rat tail, we just didn't have enough time for him to grow one.
That would have been iconic.
I refuse to have fake rat tails in my movie. People can see that a mile away. So if he wasn't willing to grow it himself, I was just absolutely not going
to
have it.
Well, that actually brings to mind how authentic did you all want this film to be? I mean, and also going back to this issue of you talking about action figures for this movie, was release, was commercialism sort of on your mind, or did you sort of worry about making the film and getting the thing finished and as reasonably authentic as possible for this notion of horror?
I think the world and the story that you create, I mean, the more authentic you can make it, the more believable it is for the audience, the more that they'll get sucked into the story and be willing to take the ride with you, you know what I mean? So you do focus on those things as much as you can. And even in our limited budget, it's you have to, you know, sort of do it in other ways, you know, whether it's just your means of doing it, you know. It's like having, you know, everybody in the city of Terminus has the same television.
Yeah.
Well, we just simply got one of those televisions and would move it to the different locations.
We did eventually return that, too, right?
Yeah, and then we returned it to Best Buy.
It was a big-ass plasma.
Big plasma TV that everyone in Terminus has, the identical TV, was returned to the store.
I was wondering about that.
But I mean, I don't think we were thinking about marketing yet when we were making
Is that what he was
just
asking?
Well, that's part of the question.
I thought he was saying...
Yeah, was just, you know, you're just trying to make a really cool movie. You know, if you can accomplish that, all the rest will follow. We were just trying to make the coolest possible movie we could make.
Yeah, what kind of movie would we like to see?
Yeah.
Did such limitations as the plasma television screen, were there anything along those lines that actually helped the feel of this movie, that helped you to kind of keep things going? I mean, in terms of the duct tape, too, I mean, it offers a particular sort of look that you're not going to get from, say, like a big Hollywood movie that's not going to think about in terms of duct tape. It's going to think in terms of CGI or, you know, expensive stuff along those lines. So, I mean, how did these help you in a way? And if you pursue another film, I mean... You know, if you have a bigger budget, do you think a bigger budget is more of a limitation for you, or is a smaller budget the kind of the way to get this sense of, I guess, this kind of kitchen sink feel?
Well, it's definitely some charm that comes from having to do everything down and dirty, and it definitely brings a different kind of gritty realism to the film. I mean, a lot of people have said, especially of the violence, that it's incredibly shocking and incredibly real and right in their face, and I think a lot of that does come from the limitations that we had to work with, you know.
We didn't have stuntmen, so it was the actors throwing themselves against.
It was to get creative, I think.
Yeah.
We had one guy who drove down from Richmond and caught himself on fire for us.
Really?
He had no crew with him. We ended up having to put him out.
Does he do this for all independent films in that area?
There's Ken Richmond. You should look him up.
If you want someone to be on fire in your movie, no matter what the genre.
Yeah. He does parties too.
Yeah. Kids parties.
But yeah, a lot of it is just, you know, you kind of
you can roast your weenies. Marshmallow, standing around with marshmallows.
You kind of live and die by, you know, what you're creating in front of the image, and there's just all these little moments in the film where I mean I don't know what protocol is, but we're like, by God, we've got to get the shot, you know, at all costs. This is one where AJ is tied duct taped to a chair, and he's got to, you know, we got to drop him, and he's got to hit the floor, and it's just not looking right, and we don't have a stunt team, and we don't know how to do it, and there's just this whole moment where he's taped up, his mouth is taped up, and everything, and you know. You just got to walk over and make eye contact with him and just sort of plead with him and go, dude, we kind of have to just do this.
That was the most anxious moment of the shoot for me, because I could see Jacob running the camera during that. And I could hear this. So I was literally duct taped to that chair. I couldn't escape. Mm-hmm. And I heard Dave and everybody
else. How'd you take a lunch break?
I heard everyone everyone over me discussing how best to make my head hit the floor and look realistic. And I'm all I can see is looking straight ahead is Jacob holding the camera on the ground. He's like, just go. Just roll right now. I'll roll on it. And, but you know, I will say that like that's probably the greatest benefit of the fact that we all knew each other.
Yeah.
So we were able to harm each other and have a higher level of trust about it. So there was some comfort in that. You know, at least it's my friend that's smashing me in the head.
You can really bludgeon your best friends way easier than you can perfect strangers. You know. Right.
In terms of this going, this kitchen sink approach, was location really very much the way for you to kind of get that production value on screen? I'm also curious as to where you filmed Terminal 13 at the end.
It was the Georgia World Congress Center. We got that location at the last minute. Yeah. We were scrounging to find a cool Terminal 13, and no one wanted it to look like an airport or like a some sort of, you know, mass transit facility. And then we kind of found that. I went looking for it, and they were really kind. They were like, yeah, you can get in here and do that. And we're like, okay. I don't think they knew how much blood we were going to spill, but so we made it happen. So
making movies is so much fun because you get to take a small army and move up into a location and then cover it with blood and dead bodies. Yeah. And then that place still has to function. You know, and the hallway where Maya's walking down, yeah, over all the bodies, like, that was my apartment building. That's where I lived at the time. And my landlord had to show apartments the day we'd covered the hallway in bodies. And that was like the longest walk of shame I've ever seen, because like everyone in the crew was just kind of staring at the floor, kind of kicking at their shoes, while she's literally going, you know, okay, oh, just step over this, don't worry about that. And the extras are just looking up, you know, playing dead, just waiting for these people to go and decide whether or not they want to rent from this place.
Were the extras so, tenants in the apartment building? Or
Please. Background artists.
Oh, okay.
Background artists.
They were friends. They were people that signed up. They were a couple of them were people, you know, that we literally were walking by on the street and we're going, what's up? And we're like, we're making a movie. You want to be dead? Yeah. And they'd come run in and lay down on the floor. So
it's just like, anybody. You get to do Halloween for, you know, an extended, yeah, period of time. You know.
Yeah. Everyone, but definitely not having, not having a big budget definitely forces you to be more creative, and it forces you to focus more on, I think, the characters and the story at its heart. I mean, I wanted to have a big spectacle with a mob scene and signalized armies at the end of it, but I couldn't do it. So it forced us to stay with what was true about the script, and you know.
Do you think, one final question, because I'm being flagged, but do you think that really independent horror is the place where innovation can now be found more so than, say, Hollywood? That really it takes more of a conceptual idea these days to scare people?
Yeah.
I think when there's not, I think independent, you know, science fiction, horror, if they're done on such a level that, you know, there's not a huge corporation breathing down their neck for it to be a tentpole of something, then you can kind of run free a little bit more and experiment and do some really exciting things and kind of make the kind of movie that you sort of were making in your head when you were 9 years old, running through the woods with your friends and their, you know, your toy guns or whatever. And I think that, and also speculating on what, you know, where we're at in terms of the world around us and technology and all the horrors that comes with that. You know, I think that, you know, not having a sort of, I don't know, we were only sort of dependent on ourselves to sort of fight it out and make sure we made the best movie possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, making this kind of movie, there's a lot of times where you reach a stumbling block and you go, I don't know, can we do that?
Yeah.
And you're, you know, fuck it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't, nobody to answer to, like, yeah, we're going to do it. Go like, for everything. Say
I was
yes,
like, I'm
know.
The producer, so yeah. Yes. You yeah. know, so it's like, yeah. it's my company, so we can do whatever we want, you know what I mean? And it's like, we challenged ourselves to sort of do that as often as possible, I think, because what do we have to lose, really, you know? Because we didn't realize that it was going to get a, you know, theatrical release, and we didn't know we were going to get into Sundance and sell it. We didn't know Magnolia was going to distribute it, so we kind of didn't have any expectations other than just to make the best movie possible.
Yeah. Is that really what filmmaking is all about, just going ahead and making something without anything to lose?
Do or die.
That's one way to do it, you know. But you can't. I don't even know at this point how you quantify all that other shit in your head. You know, you've got to focus on the movie at hand, and just trust. Like, if this thing knocks me over and kicks my ass, then it's gonna work the same for an audience. I just have to trust that.
That's true, son.
Yep.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, guys.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thanks. Take care.